This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, sitting in for Jen White. It's been more than 60 years since the Food and Drug Administration first approved the birth control pill. The pill was championed by activist Margaret Sanger, who opened the first birth control clinic in the U.S. in 1916. Here is Sanger being interviewed in 1957 by Mike Wallace.
Could it be, then, that in part at least, you were driven emotionally toward the birth control movement because of antagonism toward the church?
No, I don't think I had anything of the kind in mind. I was what I would call a born humanitarian. I don't like to see people suffer. I don't like to see cruelty, even to this day. And in nursing, you see a great deal of cruelty and unnecessary suffering.
The way we talk about birth control has definitely changed since that interview. The pill has provided control, reproductive freedom for generations of women, but there's some darkness in that history as well. Before it was introduced, the pill was tested on low-income women in Haiti and Puerto Rico. It also was not made legally available to everybody until a decade later, a decade after it hit the market. So what is the history of birth control, and how does the work as it we go forward? That's what we're talking about today. This is our first installment of a week-long series on birth control. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Crystal Littlejohn. She's a sociologist and the author of Just Get on the Pill. Welcome, Crystal.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from Indiana is Dr. Tracy Wilkinson. She's a pediatrician and board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Dr. Wilkinson, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Wilkinson, let's begin with Margaret Sanger, who is so associated with the development of the pill. Give us a little history of her involvement with the pill and how it came to market.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to take a step back and just acknowledge that women and people have been trying to kind of impact and control their fertility for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so Margaret Sanger was not the first person to really think about this. And I think that interview clip that you just played was really, you know, indicative of kind of her emotion of trying to help people and give women the control to control, you know, over their own bodies, which I think is something that is very true to the movement still.
The demand for the birth control when it first came out, was it high?
Very high. I think that, you know, the healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical industry underestimated the demand for it. And in fact, within years of the birth control pill becoming, you know, available in the United States, we saw drastic improvements in terms of the number of women finishing their education and being able to attain things in the economy that they were never able to attain before.
I do not want to completely move away from mentioning Margaret Sanger without acknowledging that she has a problematic history. After all, she advanced what was called a Negro Project in her autobiography. She gave a speech to a Ku Klux Klan group and advocated for limited eugenics. So, Crystal, there is problems in the history of Margaret Sanger. It wasn't just all about helping all people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The legacy of eugenics really haunts the history of birth control for marginalized people. The pill is absolutely a method to be celebrated. But as you're mentioning, Black women, Latinx women, poor women, right, and the list goes on, they've all seen the coercive face of birth control politics and not just the liberatory elements of the pill.
So, Crystal, Dr. Wilkinson mentioned that women were already for centuries trying to control their own bodies and either prevent pregnancy or end a pregnancy. What were people doing before the birth control came around?
Absolutely. So the birth control pill, right, was the far more effective than anything that came before it. And up until its release, people used diaphragms, they used condoms, they used withdrawal. But the pill was the first method that was so effective and that didn't actually require women to rely on their partners, right, who might not always use the methods like they were supposed to.
Dr. Wilkinson, the pill was not made available to the general public until the 1970s. Who had access to the pill at first?
Yeah, I think this gets back to the point that, you know, access has always been a battle and continues to be a battle. And some of the haunted history of kind of the development of the pill, which we were alluding to earlier with the development of the pill and kind of the focus on the eugenics movement, you know, that's not far away from where we are today, with access barriers as well as, you know, concerns of coercion for certain methods of birth control. So I want to make sure that we don't acknowledge that that's only in the past. There's still some real life battles that are continuing to happen today. And so I just wanted to say that, too.
Yeah.
It is a historical method. It's a historical thing to acknowledge, but it's a battle that we're still fighting today.
And it's interesting, in that clip with Mike Wallace interviewing Margaret Sanger, he implied that she was, at least in some, to some extent, promoting birth control as a way to get back at the church. So the birth control movement and the attempt to make it accessible to everyone has never been fully, is it fair to say, Crystal, that it's never been fully divorced from the ideas of church and God?
I think that it's fair to say that religion has played a huge role in the history of the development of birth control and of trying to get people to think about how to manage their fertility. I absolutely agree with that.
We got this message from Martha, who tweeted, "I want to share my late mom's experience with getting the pill in the early 60s. A confirmed Catholic, rhythm method did not work. After 5 children in 6 years, she was diagnosed as ovulating twice a month." Dr. Wilkinson, can you give us a rundown on exactly how the birth control works?
Yeah, that's a great question. So primarily it works by preventing ovulation. And ovulation is the term that we use to describe when an egg is released from your ovary. And so if you prevent that egg from being released, that's how it effectively prevents pregnancy.
Has it changed since this first pill came out? Has that particular method changed at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, a vast majority of the birth control methods we have right now that are hormonal birth control methods work that way, by somewhat providing the hormones to, you know, maybe trick your body to thinking that they don't need to do that regular cycle of releasing the egg. And so, yeah, the basics behind the birth control pill that was developed decades ago are still the basics that we're using today.
And Rodney emails this, "Please elaborate on experiments of birth control pills in Haiti and Puerto Rico. This is the first I've heard. Was this just another example of a Tuskegee experiment?" The Tuskegee experiment was the Tuskegee syphilis study. The U.S. government conducted research on black men in Alabama for 40 years. But Crystal, can you tell us a little bit more of the first human trials of the birth control pill, which were conducted on low-income women in both Haiti and Puerto Rico?
Sure. So as mentioned, the first trials of birth control in Puerto Rico, those women were instrumental in helping us develop the methods that so many people use today. And they dealt with pills that had much higher doses of hormones than we have in our pills today. They dealt with side effects. People had to pull out of the trials because of the negative experiences that they were having. And so it's fascinating and I think saddening that people don't know more about how important those women were in helping us develop the methods that we have and really how much they suffered in order for us to be able to have methods that are more effective than anything that came before them.
We're discussing the history of birth control. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from Wells Fargo, donating approximately $420 million through its Open for Business Fund to help women and diverse-owned small businesses rebuild from the pandemic. So far, the effort is helping protect an estimated 66,000 small business jobs nationwide. More at wellsfargo.com/together.
The Indicator from Planet Money is your daily source for economic stories, stories that peel back this onion we know as the U.S. economy. Today on the show, desperately seeking construction workers. Forget everything you thought you knew about the unemployment numbers. 10 minutes or less, that is all it takes for us to explain what is going on with all those numbers. Listen and follow The Indicator from NPR.
We're discussing the history of birth control. Let's get back to that conversation. So when we talk about the first introduction of the birth control pill, and as we've mentioned, it's very difficult to disentangle birth control and the access to it from religion, but also from race and class. So how does that play into how it was accessible or how it was offered at the very beginning in the 1960s and 70s? Crystal, was there a difference of whether you had access to the birth control pill according to whether you were a woman of color, whether you're a woman of a different income, and also whether you are married?
Yes. So I would say single women really got the short end of the stick in the early years of birth control use because the government prohibited the sale of birth control to single women. It was only in 1972, as you mentioned, 10 years after the FDA first approved the pill, that the Supreme Court decided that states couldn't prohibit the sale of birth control to single women, and instead that it had to be available for everybody. So even though we think about the pill as being 60 years old in this country, people had very uneven experiences with use, and that also extends to the experiences of women of color and poor women who have, as I mentioned, had very different experiences with how their fertility is thought about in this country.
And Dr. Wilkinson, do you think some of those issues related to race and class are still being seen today in women's access to birth control?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that women of color, and I want to clarify that I do keep using the word women, but there are plenty of people that don't identify as women that need birth control.
Yeah, it's a great point.
So I just want to give the listeners that clarification. I will probably keep saying women, but a lot of that is because a vast majority of the research has been on women and not bringing in different types of self-identifying people as well as women of color into these trials. So we know that when you have no insurance or Medicaid, or when you have any diversity in terms of your background, you have less access to healthcare. And right now, birth control is quarantined into requiring healthcare visits. If you want a hormonal form of birth control, in most states, that requires a visit to a clinician. And that is an access barrier.
Carol emails this. In 1966, I went with my three roommates to get the pill. I was the only one who was given the pill because I lied and I said I was getting married. And here's what Mary in Columbia, Maryland had to say.
Back in the 60s, I was not getting a regular period. My mother was worried, took me to the local doctor. He prescribed birth control to regulate my period. They were so strong. I was sick. I couldn't keep any food down. I was like green. After the third day, my mom said, I don't care what the problem is with her period. I'm not forcing her to take these birth control pills anymore. I'm sure happy they have regulated the dosage since then.
And Connecting Nodes tweets this: the pill does much more than birth control. I have a hormone imbalance. It helped me a lot. I'm far from alone. Thank God it gave an easy option for birth control, and it's a resource for other medical issues. Dr. Wilkinson, how else is the pill used besides birth control?
It's a great question, and it reminds me that it actually was approved in 1960 for menstrual regulation with the side effect of birth control, which is always this interesting historical fact that I like to think about because we don't remember that when we use birth control as much these days. But I talk a lot about menstrual regulation, and as a pediatrician, I use it a lot for patients, not for pregnancy prevention, but to have regular periods, to have lighter periods. It also decreases the risks of various forms of cancer, which is a great thing to think about when you are taking a medication.
I wonder your reaction to what Mary also said about the side effects. How has the pill changed in terms of regulation of the dosage, as she pointed out, in terms of the kind of side effects women have?
Yeah, so Mary's point is spot on. You know, the original pill that was approved was a much, different dose of estrogen and progesterone, which are the hormones in a birth control pill, than the pills that we have on the market today. And so I would say that the side effects, because the doses are much lower, are much more tolerable, and they're much more safer because of the lower doses of hormones that are being used.
And we are talking about the history of the birth control pill and bringing it to market. And I wonder, Crystal, what was the debate like before the birth control pill got approved for sale, and specifically among women, because this was not a united chorus among women that they wanted a birth control pill.
Yeah. So there was, I think many women wanted to have a method, obviously, that could help them regulate their fertility and prevent pregnancy when they weren't looking to have a family or start or expand their family. But there were also people who believed that that wasn't what women should be doing and what people who could get pregnant should be doing, that instead the real purpose of women was to be able to have families, to stay home. And so especially in the early years of folks trying to manage their fertility and trying to get access to birth control for women, there was some debate about what that should look like and whether or not it was in women's best interest to have methods that, or to promote methods that would encourage them not to have kids.
I don't want to make it sound like that was a majority, that was a minority of women. But I wonder, as you've covered the history of birth control, are there echoes between those arguments that they had when the birth control pill first became available to some of the arguments we're seeing today?
Yes, I think especially when you think about how there are some folks out there who encourage or try and kind of flip the discourse on its head when it comes to the fertility of Black women and Black people who can get pregnant, as Dr. Wilkin was mentioning. And so there are people who try and encourage Black people, Black birthing people and Black people who can get pregnant, not to use birth control, arguing that there are forces out there trying to undermine their fertility, trying to not allow them to have kids. And that's absolutely the case, right? They do absolutely face pressure to limit their families and to limit their fertility. But it's also the case that many, many people need birth control and believe that access is vital, and that some of those arguments are not good faith arguments for supporting the rights of people who can get pregnant, but instead are about a divisive politics that seeks to undermine their rights.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects, available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it, or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Now let's get back to our conversation about the history of birth control. Do you think culturally the perception of birth control has changed?
Yeah, social thinking about sex and birth control have completely shifted since the approval of the pill. There's much more celebration of women's sexuality and people's sexuality, and a much more honest conversation about how many people need birth control to live their best lives. So younger people, single people, they don't have to feel the same weight of such a heavy stigma around sex. Obviously, it's still there, but the stigma around sex isn't as heavy as it used to be. And the pill made it much more likely that people could enjoy their lives without the constant concern that they could become pregnant and have their lives change dramatically. So even though there are still challenges, it's been a dramatic shift.
It's possible, don't you think, Crystal, that all of the debate over the pill, the fact that it was so controversial, and politicians and religious leaders and lots of people were talking about it and debating it and arguing over it, that might have helped normalize it.
I think that before things enter the mainstream of acceptance, they oftentimes go through this period of having to debate, of having to hear different sides, and of really bringing awareness to an issue that some people might not know about. And so I think that has been a big part of the process of normalizing the importance of birth control for people, is just going through that intense process of growing pains to get people on board with how important it is.
We got an email from Suzelle who says, I first accessed the birth control pill as a 15-year-old in 1975 after having an abortion. I am white, middle class, and had parental support. The access issues exacerbated by the religious right are distressing. Now I'm a pastor and eager to help women gain access to the means to control their fertility and take care of their reproductive health. Dr. Wilkinson, how does the history, not just the history of the pill and its development, but this argument and public debate we've been talking about, how do you think that has affected how well-informed your patients are?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that debate is still going on. I mean, you know, it wasn't long ago that we were talking about Title X funding in the United States with the previous administration, and whether we could even provide funding for comprehensive reproductive health care for those most in need. And that debate continues, where we have data, we have evidence that access to birth control is really, really good for a lot of reasons. And we still have barriers being put up by legislatures and politicians because they don't believe that that is a priority for their constituents. And so I think because this debate continues, because this debate is heated, there's a lot of misinformation out there on what is real and what is not real.
And I'll remind our listeners, Title X was actually part of the Public Health Service Act that was signed by President Richard Nixon in 1970. It's the only federal grant program that's focused on family planning and preventive health services, etc. We got this message from Sue in Connecticut.
I got married in 1962, had a baby in 1963, and was terrified of asking the doctor for any help in how to not have another baby right away. And it turned, because birth control was against the law in Connecticut, and you couldn't discuss it and you couldn't ask for it or dispense it or use it. So luckily, this wonderful doctor knew how to meet my needs, and he was 85 and just the sweetest old family doctor. And he said with a wink, you know, we have a new prescription that we can use that will help you, wink, wink, regulate your cycle.
Thank you so much, Sue, for that. It's fascinating to me having, you know, the pill has always been available since I've been alive. It's fascinating to me to hear these stories about times when the pill was new or maybe not available. But I also want to talk about men here, because in your book, Crystal, called Just Get on the Pill, you argue that the burden of responsibility when it comes to birth control falls unfairly on women and always had. On Twitter, I asked, how important is birth control to you? And Brenton Polk, a male, says, very, because one day I want a relationship and no children. How did this idea that birth control is a female issue start?
I think with the development of the pill and the use of methods that were more effective than anything that came before them, we had more of a shift toward trying to get people to prevent pregnancy using methods that were so highly effective. And I think you see this in people's families, with their friends, with our public health approaches to preventing pregnancy, where there's an emphasis on using prescription birth control methods like the pill, like the IUD, like the shot, that are really highly effective. And we can have an unintended, I think, de-emphasis on using condoms, which are technically effective, right? They're quite effective when used consistently and correctly, but less effective when people don't use them as they're supposed to. And so in my book, I talk about how our society applies intense social pressure to use birth control only on people who can get pregnant and not on their partners. So rather than telling couples that both people can and should contribute to preventing pregnancy, our society really pushes women to largely go it alone using methods that are designed for their body. And I show that has a number of unintended negative consequences.
And many listeners are interested in talking about birth control for men. Was it always intended that birth control would target women's bodies? When did at least the discussion of a male birth control pill begin?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, getting back to the idea of condoms, those have been around for centuries. The idea of, you know, using various parts of animal bodies to create a barrier. But I do think it's disappointing that, you know, decades after the birth control pill, we really haven't had substantial development of any hormonal method for men. And that isn't to say that it couldn't exist. It just really hasn't been a focus of, you know, the pharmaceutical industry as well as research and development into birth birth control methods. And I think that, you know, to Crystal's point, there would probably be more interest than people believe there would be, because we're getting to a point where, you know, women are demanding equality in relationships and equality in burdens and mental loads. And it would be amazing if this wasn't completely on our, plate to take care of all the time.
The birth control pill was intended to prevent pregnancy, obviously, but it ended up being a symbol, Crystal. This is also something that you write about, a symbol for women's equality, autonomy, liberation. And it has that reputation now. Eileen tweets 100% effective, 100% affordable, 100% accessible, 100% reliable, 100% reversible birth control would change everything for women to achieve equality. Why did the pill become so closely associated with feminism and women's liberation?
The real key there for me is having a method that women could control by, or that people could control by themselves. And there's talk of being able to use it covertly in times when people needed to use it covertly. And because of the discrimination that women face in the workplace, that because of the heavy burden that they face for caring for children, whether or not they can control their fertility ends up being a really big part of their ability to achieve economic independence, to achieve economic mobility, and to really live the kinds of lives that they want to live. And so I think because of the power of the pill for controlling, or at least being able to manage their fertility much better, it really became a symbol for, as you're saying, for liberation, for reproductive autonomy. Even as I mentioned, we know that people's experiences differ by race and class. The pill in itself does stand as one of the most important tools for achieving the kind of reproductive freedom that people have been longing for, as Dr. Wilkinson mentioned, for centuries.
So, Dr. Wilkinson, how do you see this argument, even among the medical community, that brings in issues that are unrelated to physiological health or even emotional health in order to either allow people access or prevent them from having access to birth control?
Yeah, I mean, those stories are devastating because, you know, it's putting clinicians' views and priorities and morals ahead of a patient, which to me as a physician is the counterpoint of why you are in medicine to begin with. And so we're really seeing a movement within the reproductive health field that is patient-centered and centered on what's important for patients and allowing them to really choose, which is something we should have been doing for decades, right? We should have been listening to women and hearing what they wanted out of birth control and what they wanted out of, like, their fertility planning. And instead, the, you know, mainstay has been more, we'll make that decision for you, which gets into some of these very, very, like, disturbing historical as well as present, stories of people making decisions based on what they think is best for you without really having a lot of right to do that.
As we're looking at the history of the birth control pill, not only how it was developed, but how it was brought to market and made accessible to people, what lessons can you take away from that history that might help us in this debate today? Let me begin with you, Crystal.
The biggest thing is making sure that we meet patients where they are and that we give them the methods that they need, rather than trying to assume that we know what patients want, and rather than assuming that they just need to push through to get their own needs met. We need to make sure that we're thinking about where they're coming from, that we work on having methods that work for everybody, and that, as we've been talking about in this conversation, that we start to develop more methods for all of the different kinds of bodies that exist so that everybody that wants to prevent pregnancy can do so.
Dr. Wilkinson, same question to you. What does the history of the birth control pill teach us that might be relevant today?
Yeah, you know, in preparing for this interview, I learned a lot myself and was saddened that this similar kind of theme of, you know, problematic and questionable methods to developing these drugs were used and had, a troubled past, a racist past, a eugenics past. But I do think what Crystal said was spot on, that we need to focus on how birth control is accessible and provided today, and to make sure that we are building trust with the communities that maybe have had a little broken trust due to the history of the development.
Does that mean legislative change? I mean, does policy need to change to bring about what you're describing?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see increased access. And I know you'll talk about this on future episodes this week, but, you know, over-the-counter access, pharmacy access, being able to access birth control through the mail, not restricting birth control only to a face-to-face encounter with a clinician, and making sure that people, regardless of their insurance status, their immigration status, their income, can access birth control when they want it.
Crystal, do you think that in order to bring about what you think needs to happen, does that require policy change?
I think it's policy in addition to changes in social thinking. I think that we need on-the-ground changes to help us understand that reproductive autonomy should be at the center of our discussions of birth control, and that we should be helping people achieve their reproductive goals in order to make sure we're fulfilling the promise of the pill.
Crystal Littlejohn is a sociologist and the author of Just Get on the Pill. Crystal, thank you so much for joining us. And Dr. Tracy Wilkinson is a pediatrician and board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Many thanks to Tracy as well. Today's conversation was produced by Arfi Getty. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee in for Jen White. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.